Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
And welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. I'm your host, Veronica Monet. I'm rather excited about tonight's topic. We're going to be talking about eco-sexuality. No, I don't think I quite know what that means. I could guess at it, but we've got an expert with us tonight. Serena Anderlini Donofrio. She is the professor of humanities at the University of Puerto Rico. She is a blogger on Polyplanet Gaia. She is editor of Bitopia, Bisexuality and Queer Theory, Plural Loves, and Women and Bisexuality. She's also the author of Gaia, of Eros, and The Weak Subject. So I am really, really pleased to bring Serena onto the Shame-Free Zone. Serena, you're actually in New York tonight, aren't you?
Yes, Veronica. I'm here in the vicinity of New York, enjoying the weather.
Oh, and come on. Are you really enjoying the weather in New York?
It's not bad. Today was warm, and we went to the pool. It wasn't too warm.
Okay, because usually it's a little muggy in the summertime in New York.
Yes, it can be muggy.
Yeah. So you and I actually have a mutual friend, Annie Sprinkle, and her partner, Beth.
Yes.
And I understand that you have recently done some, art project in San Francisco with them?
Yes, the Ecosexuality Symposium and Art Exhibit. It was the world's second Ecosexuality Symposium in San Francisco. It was from the 17th to the 19th of June at the New Center for Sex and Culture with Carol Queen.
And Robert Lawrence's place.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
Yep.
So can you tell us, first of all, the listeners I'm sure are anxious to find out, what is ecosexuality? Is that a term that's succinctly defined, or is it kind of a movement, or what are we talking about here?
Yes, well, there are many ways to look at ecosexuality as it is happening in the moment as a movement and as a new sexual mode of expression. And we don't want to pin it down to a simple definition, but we want to give some perspective on what the movement is doing. One approach is to think about shifting the metaphor from the earth as mother to the earth as lover. As ecosexuals, we would like to treat the earth as a lover with respect. And so we encourage others to do the same. And it might help to really shift the metaphor in some ways so that we always consider the earth as our partner rather than mother. Often mothers get exploited a lot in society. The mother's responsibility is always giving, 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 giving. And she is often considered a resource that can never be exploited enough or that can never finish.
We're back to the old saying, woman's work is never done, right?
Yes. So that's one way to look at it. Another way is to look at ecosexuality as a way to make the environmental movement more sexy, fun, and diverse. And there are many other ways. And one way that is dear to me is to look at love as the ecology of life. When we think of life, You know, the only way to keep the cycle of life going is really love, is when we commune, we connect with others, that we keep the cycle of life going on our hostess, the third planet. And so it's a sense of gratefulness for this planet that is generous enough to host us and all the other species that accompany us in these journeys of life. And it's a way to acknowledge the fact that without love there is no life, and that we are very blessed with this hostess, and that it would be a great idea to respect her. In a way, a hostess is a mother and a lover. A mother hosts us in our first 9 months of life, and lovers always also often open their doors for us. They welcome us in their lives. So that's another way to look at it. But it's something that is really in progress. And the interesting part is being part of ecosexuality is that that's where art meets theory, meets practice, meets activism. So it's all these things at the same time and in conjunction. So it's really where there's a new synergy of something that could be the beginning of a new approach to our relationship with nature and with ourselves.
So one of the things that we could do to probably get a little more specific is actually talk about some of the different projects. Because you've got a lot of different eco-sexual projects going on around the globe. Maybe we could start by talking about the art project that you just did in San Francisco with Annie Sprinkle and with Beth Stevens. And then we'll go from there. We'll work our way to Italy and Germany. But first of all, what was the art project about, and what were Annie and Beth up to? Were they doing another wedding?
In San Francisco, they were not doing another wedding this summer. They did one wedding in Barcelona, I believe, to the rocks, and another one in northern Spain to the coal. And San Francisco was mainly a symposium. But it was really also a place to think about, you know, what sexuality is, and there were various themes. What I did for them is I gave a keynote speech where I spoke about the art of conscious loving. My focus was really more ecosexual love, not so much as a sexuality, but as a style of love. And there was something very important that I learned from this symposium. Something that really helped me help myself understand ecosexuality better. And I want to just give a little glimpse of it. We as human beings have become very disconnected from the metabolism of the earth. We really deny our being part of this metabolism in so many ways. And with the ecosexuality, it offers a way to reconnect with that metabolism. For example, there was a piece on the sea, on the ocean, on the liquid bodies of the earth, and it connected this desire to be part of that, to be in connection with the oceans, with a desire that we have for the mother, for the beginning of life that every human being has in the liquid of the amniotic liquid of the container where we are brought to life. And so, you know, to look at that as this sort of the philia that some people have for the water is something that really is a reminder of this beginning of our lives and of, you know, of life in general. Life, all life comes from the water. Another example would be of how disconnected we are. You know, if we look at plants, flowers are actually this plant's genitals. And a plant will never hide its genitals.
No, it puts it right out there for everybody.
Right?
And then we very obligingly stick our noses into it.
We display them in our living rooms and everything, and we consider them very decorative. But then, in relation to our bodies, we are always a bit concerned about, you know, who is going to see our genitals. So that's how disconnected we have become from the metabolism of the earth. You know, our own metabolism has become disconnected, and that can't be very healthy for our species or for our environment.
Now, you know, Serena, one of the things that I was very shocked to find was that there was actually some online chat rooms where young mothers are trying to figure out if breastfeeding is child molestation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
exactly.
As a species, we have gotten so far away from our biology that we have forgotten mm-hmm. what it means to be a mammal, which means you feed your young through the mammary glands. Women can pretty well expose their breasts any way they choose, but unless they go to actually feed a baby with one of their breasts.
Right, right. There was a DVD from Annie Sprinkle that I got at the symposium. It's called Orgasm, and it expands notion of orgasm, including birth-child delivery. Apparently,
yes.
Some women who reconstitute this connectedness with nature and with our own metabolism and the metabolism of the earth manage to experience child delivery as an orgasm. It's possible.
Absolutely. The baby's head actually pounds against the pelvic floor. So.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And if we think of how, you know, we teach our children from day one that that's going to be a terrible experience, that it's going to be pain, that it's going to be medicalized, in reality, it could be an orgasmic experience. And another very interesting piece in that DVD is this midwife for death who actually helps the passage of a person who is dying as an orgasmic passage, so that an orgasm can practically accompany us virtually from birth to death.
Yes, and add to that, Serena, the fact that a lot of masturbation actually originates in utero, so that fetuses are actually masturbating to the point of orgasm while they're still in the womb.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to say orgasm should take you from the womb to whatever, you're getting cremated or, I guess, the casket, whatever, the grave. Some people still refer to it as the grave, but from the womb to the grave.
Yes.
I do think
those are just some of the examples of, what the potential of ecosexuality. It really is so vast because one can reconfigure, reimagine a lot of the ordinary things of life in a different light.
Tell us a little bit now. You've just went to Germany. And you were actually at one of the ZEG communities. Now, for our listeners, they may not. ZEG is spelled Z-E-G-G.
Yes.
Z-E-G-G.
Yes.
And it's
yes.
an intentional community. And you were at their summer camp. Before you tell us about the ecosexual love conference that you, I don't know if you were teaching a workshop there or attending.
The ecosexual love symposium?
Yeah, was that at ZEG community?
Oh,
in Germany?
ZEG had an interesting theme this year. ZEG is one of the largest and the oldest intentional communities that have also embraced, at least as a possibility, the idea of multi-partnering and free love or open love. And the theme this year was Eros and Community. They had many invited speakers. And so I decided to tuck it in between different parts of my legs of my trip because of the theme was so interesting. And there was an international group that was taking the summer camp. The summer camp also involves the practice of the forum. And the forum is this place where people in some ways reenact a bit their psychodrama in front of a group that is concerned and then gives them mirrors and feedback and some facilitation. So I was very attracted to that. And once we were there, as a coincidence, also Kamala Devi was there, who was
Kamala Devi. She's
yes.
doing her one-woman show.
Yes.
Actually,
yes.
And doing...
Yes, and so we... when we had open space, we took advantage to bring to lead two workshops on ecosexuality and on polyamory, and we realized how much interest there was in the workshop. The workshop I gave there, a very simple workshop there on ecosexuality, was a way to really consider the concept of compersion, which I take from polyamory. Polyamory in comparison, polyamory is a bit the spirit of compersion is a bit the spirit of polyamory in the sense that it's the ability to hold the space for love for others. And in this simple workshop, I adapt this concept to heterosexuality, saying, let's look for a moment at who holds the space for love for us. It's really our hostess planet that holds the largest space of love, your life survives. And so I look at people with a wider compersion as those people who really are more heterosexual, more closer. They're closer to this concept, to this practice of heterosexuality.
So in some ways, Serena, it sounds like you are talking about enlarging your love circle, if you will, where you start feeling more connected to the animals and the planet.
Yes, I wish I could hear you a bit better. I am, the line is very disturbed.
I think we are having enough interference here that we're probably going to have to interrupt our broadcast long enough to dial back in. So,
yeah, it is very disturbed right now, and I can't hear the question.
You know, if you're listening live, I apologize for that interruption. We were having some technical difficulties for our line from New York to Paradise, but we are back in commission here, and hopefully we'll have better reception. And I don't know if you could hear it at your end, but at our end it was getting pretty problematic there. Anyway, we are talking to Serena Anderlini Donofrio, and she is calling us from New York City tonight to talk to us about ecosexuality. Some of the points that we've covered so far are that ecosexual love actually can be something that embraces the planet and her creatures, and that in some ways ecosexuality can actually be an enlarging of our concept of sexuality, so that we really start to look around and realize that that even birth can be an orgasmic experience, that fetuses are, some of them anyway, maybe not all of them, but quite a few of them are masturbating to the point of orgasm in the womb, in utero. And there are some caregivers who are actually starting to experiment with the idea of giving orgasms at the moment of death. So we're really starting to see how sexuality can be a lifelong pursuit or spiritual practice, an enrichment, something that adds a dimension to life that perhaps we've been treating something as being more taboo. So, Serena, you were getting ready to tell us about the ZEG community. That's Z-E-G-G in Germany. They have a summer camp there, and they're an intentional community. And you were there, I believe, presenting on ecosexuality. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, it was a very brief presentation during the day when participants in the summer camp were offered the opportunity to present their projects of their interest. And so I gave a workshop on ecosexuality, and my emphasis there was really to look at the Earth, the third planet, as the hostess of our lives, the lives of all the creatures that exist on Gaia, as some scientists call the third planet, and to really look at this as a form of compersion. In polyamory, we use compersion as something that is a bit the spirit of polyamory, the ability to hold the space for love for others. Even when love happens between people that, you know, don't include us, we can still participate in the creation of that love by holding that space. And that is exactly what the Earth is doing for us. If we consider that love is the ecology of life, that without love, life would disappear and our planet would become similar to Mars and Venus, then we can understand how really the being with the largest compersion, the largest ability to host and to contemplate love is the third planet. And so it was a very simple workshop with some exercise that really focused on not so much the giver and the receiver of love, but the person who holds space, the person who is present to the beauty and the magic of this event, love.
Would you say
that's what that's what I did in EdZEG, but it was very brief.
Okay, so I have a question for you, Serena, and that would be if you are in some ways putting out there that the planet, our Mother Earth, is perhaps composed of love. Are you suggesting that the planet is loving?
The planet is very loving. There's no doubt about it. I mean, why would a planet that hosts life not be loving? You see, the energy of life is really love. And this is something also I spoke at the Ecosexuality Symposium in San Francisco. If we go back to the beginnings of life, you know, we look at back at our first ancestors, the first time that life appeared on the planet is when bacteria appeared. And that's when love, consciousness, and sex begin, according to scientists, especially Gaian scientists. And we see that even in that very minimal movement of one bacterium toward another bacterium, there is consciousness, because without consciousness, there can't be any choice. And in that communion, in that union, there is love. And the thing is that we as humans often believe that we have invented love, but that's very presumptuous, because in reality, according to science, love pre-exists humans. And in bacteria, very simple organisms that are still alive for 4 billion years, they have been welcome on our planet. For bacteria, love is not reproductive. Each bacterium has everything it needs to divide and form two bacteria. However, bacteria have lots of sex. So they have sex for fun. They have sex to rejuvenate, to exchange genes, to feel more alive. And I think that, you know, going back to these very simple ancestors of life, we can understand a lot of what's very simple, you know, that we as humans have forgotten, that really love is the ecology of life.
So let me just put what you just said into other words and see if I got this straight. You're basically saying that bacteria are hermaphrodites. They've got both sexes. They could reproduce with themselves. They don't need to reproduce.
No. Bacteria are unicellular organisms, and all unicellular organisms are reproduced by dividing.
Right.
They simply break into and they reproduce.
But what you're saying, that they choose to reproduce through sexual interaction.
No, they don't need. They don't need to reproduce. They don't need to have sex to reproduce, but they choose to have sex for fun.
And how do they do that?
They exchange genes. They get together with one another.
Okay. So
they are symbiotic.
Yeah, that's basically what I was just saying. So in other words, they don't need to do to reproduce that way, but they do.
Yes. Often we think that sex has evolved because it is necessary for reproduction. But that's to think a lot. That's to really think that we humans are the only model. In our species, sex is necessary for reproduction unless we use artificial insemination. But in many other species, sex is really not what is necessary for reproduction, especially these very simple organisms. However, sex did evolve as a form of symbiosis, a form of communion, of being with others, as a form of rejuvenation, of keeping the energy of life going.
And you were talking about the bacteria actually engaging in sex because it creates more of an energetic.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's what scientists, I'm quoting mostly the work of Lynn Margulis, who is one of those, he's a Gaian scientist, but she focuses on the microcosm. She doesn't focus on the macrocosm, on the whole planet, on the life of the third planet from the beginning to the end, on the planet, on the solar system. She works on the microscopic aspects, and she's very clear about this, that, you know, these forms of life that are very simple have been around for 4 billion years, and that if we can accept that these are our ancestors, we can understand a lot of things about us as well. And that it is very presumptuous to think that we humans have invented love. That is very anthropomorphic. It's like, you know, if it's not human, it's not love. So we have invented it. But there is no demonstration in that. Because in reality, love is the energy of life. And it has happened the minute that life started to happen, love started to happen. The form was a bit different. It couldn't be simply a form of symbiosis. You know, life, these little organisms, to keep alive, they also have to get together. They have to be close to one another, and they have to cooperate, and that's symbiosis.
These
evolutionary scientists also claim that evolution happens by selection, but it also happens by symbiosis, which is a form of collaboration. And that's another way to love. We know that, you know, we help people. Why? Because we love them.
It's a fascinating concept. How was that received at the ZEG community in Germany? Were they?
Well, as I said, at ZEG, I didn't have a chance to go into all these details. What the place where we had a more elaborate course on ecosexuality was really in northern Italy, in a town called Cervento, where we had a whole house, and we had a group of participants that was very diverse, from New Zealand to Turkey, and many other countries in between. We had about 9 participants and 2 facilitators and 2 staff members. And we were all in this house in this gorge of the Alps, the Italian Alps, not far from Milan. And that's where we did a 5-day course of ecosexuality called Ecosexuality, the Arts of Conscious Loving. There were 2 facilitators, Robert Silber of Hawaii and myself. And there we actually were quite articulate in looking at all the aspects from the most global to the most microscopic and personal. And we worked on 3 concepts. One was conscious sensuality, the idea of teaching conscious sensuality is that if we can expand the range of sensations that we can hold, that we can experience, sensations of pleasure or even pain, then we can extend the range of emotions that we can metabolize in our system. And so we can become more connected to the communities, to people around us. Often we become disconnected. Why? Because we are clenched in fear. But if we can experience more sensations, then that emotion of fear can be turned around as well, and we feel the connectedness again. So that was one point. Then another point was that once we do expand this range of emotions, then we can look at love in more inclusive ways. Like, we can include elements of nature into our love, as in, you know, the weddings of Annie Sprinkle and Bette Stevens, who marry a force of nature, be it the wind, the cold, the rocks, or the sea, or the moon, including parts of Gaia, parts of the third planet in our practice of love as partners, and also including other people. You know, there are so many people in the world who don't have the love they want, but they maybe can get some of what they need if we open up our relationship to them, if we become more inclusive in our amorous practices. And so that was another point. And then also looking at what really in the modern era has divided sexuality in two. We often, when we think of sexuality, we think of heterosexuality and homosexuality. And for many people, that's just what there is. And for some people, homosexuality is still quite taboo. And why have we built this wall? I call that divide as the Berlin Wall or the Iron Curtain. It's about time to tear it apart. What is it doing? and consider that really sexuality is fluid, that the energy of love, you know, if love is the ecology of life, then the energy of love, the erotic energy, is really what makes us alive. And why are we stopping it from circulating by creating this artificial device that, if we look back to the history of our species, they didn't exist before modernity arrived. So they are not necessary. They are cultural constructs that are actually in the way of a more resourceful and more optimized use of resources of love. One thing that I always recommend to people who are interested in ecosexuality is to begin to think of ourselves as resources of love. See, if we think of love as an art, and that's where really, when we talk about ecosexuality, it's where art meets theory, meets practice, meets activism, so ecosexuality is also an art form or a style of art, then we see that love is also an art, or at least it can be interpreted as an art. And if we do interpret it as an art, if we form cultures where love is interpreted as an art, then we see that we can produce it. and we can become resources of love in the same way that, you know, an artist is a resource, creative, a resource to the society that needs the creativity of artists. So artists of love are resources. We know how to generate love. See, if we consider love prevalently as a need, I'm not saying that love is not a need, but if it is primarily interpreted as a need, we create a culture where there's never enough love because everybody wants love, but nobody knows how to generate it. When we consider love as an instinct, things are even worse because then everybody becomes afraid of love. And so we create a society where we have erotophobia, fear of love.
Fear of love.
Right, erotophobia. Erotophobia. It's a fear of love. And entire societies can be clenched in this fear. And then they become very violent societies, typically. How do we turn this around? By reinterpreting or interpreting, again, love as an art. When we interpret love as an art, we see that what in other societies can be considered an instinct now could be a talent. You see, when we interpret love as an art, all styles of love are beautiful. Why? Because art is beautiful when it's different. We don't want all painters to paint in the same style. And all desires can be considered talents that if properly educated, if properly schooled artistically, then they can become a resource of love. So that people who have these talents and develop them as artists of love can become resources of love for the societies and the cultures that we live in. And I do.
So are you talking about sex workers with this?
That, of course, includes sex workers. Sex workers are very generous artists of love many times.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're very important resources of love for societies. They're people who deserve the highest respect for what they do.
Why do you think that we live in a world where sex workers receive the least amount of respect?
That's a good question, because we have created a culture where there is fear of love. You know, when we primarily interpret love as an instinct, we become afraid of love. Because we feel, you know, that instincts are something wild, something uncontrollable, and so love becomes criminalized. And so then, you know, we don't respect those who are resources of love or choose to function as resources of love, even though it's not often accepted by society. It's not legal, for example, in many societies.
Yeah, it's a tremendous amount of taboo. We do live in a world where violence seems to be very acceptable, sometimes almost worshipped, I think. And yet, I mean, I certainly know growing up in a Christian church, we had songs about being Christian soldiers marching on as to war.
That was
a song I sang quite often in church.
Right, right. Then, you know, even religions like Christianity, which was really a nonviolent religion at the beginning, you know, offered the other cheek, become dogmatic and militarized. And so, and if you look at this at the levels of the chakras, which is an interesting part of the work that inspires me and Annie and Beth, because their weddings to these forces of nature are usually of a color of a certain chakra. So there is a theme that really connects the weddings with these openings according to Hindu understanding of the human body, are these openings in our energetic system in our body. So if you look at the chakras of the abdomen, the sex center, and then the dantian, this is where fear is located. When we are afraid, we hold our breath and we feel a clench in that area, in the dantian, the belly, the abdomen, right?
Right.
So then when we interpret, when culturally we interpret love as an instinct, we feel that it's something uncontrollable, you know, something like this fear that clenches us. So we come associate love with this fear, and we criminalize it.
So this is one of the reasons that you are speaking about love as an art.
As an art, exactly, because we can move that energy and say, okay, that instinct that becomes criminalized could be a misunderstood, misinterpreted talent that could instead be educated. And the problem is with today's educational system also. You know, where are the schools where we can teach love? We often consider knowledge something that we use to compete with others, not really to help them.
Yeah, it's definitely collaboration and cooperation
right.
are not really valued, especially not in the United States. Have you found this
right.
to be the case in other Western cultures? So you've been to Italy recently and Germany. Is that attitude of, you know, of being very competitive, has it kind of infected the rest of the globe, or have you found pockets of...
Thank you for the question. I do believe that that countries where the public education system works well and is accessible to the public and is based on merit and dedication do produce societies that are less violent. It's inevitable. You know, education is the basis of democracy. And democracy is a nonviolent system of government where nobody is in charge, but the public is in charge. So that said, I do find that in some, the places where I do find that the education of love is possible are most intentional communities, and that's why I go to many of them. Intentional communities are open, that are progressive, help form these social spaces where people come and with an openness to learning about love as an art. That's why I was attracted to ZEG. That's why I went to Kalikalos, this other intentional community in Greece, where they often invite me also to teach a little bit about Gaia theory, about polyamory, about ecosexuality. These are places where people go with the spirit of sharing, see, of living according to principles that are more collaborative, more symbiotic than what we find in competitive society. So that's why I feel that those are biotopes, places where a new synergy is created between human beings and the earth. And the glue, the energy of that synergy, is precisely love as the ecology of life, or one could say ecosexual love. I don't know if that helps, but that's what I would say. I find that places where education to love is possible are often not exactly in the institutions of education, but a bit outside, especially in these intentional communities.
Intentional
Another
communities
place,
are often more polyamorous, are they?
Not necessarily. Intentional communities are not polyamorous, but some of the most open intentional communities that really choose to live on principles that are more ecological, they're more holistic, are open to different styles of love, because that's part of, you know, the holism. There isn't a prescription as to how one has to love, because if the way that we can love is too prescribed, then a whole bunch of other ways are considered bad, and then those options are lost. See, if we teach the arts of loving, then every talent of love can become developed. That's one thing that I teach also in my course at the University of Puerto Rico. I teach a course in Western civilization, and I begin with, of course, Mesopotamia and all the prehistory, and then, you know, Egypt and so on and so forth. But what I do teach is how love was practiced at these different times. And when the students finished the course, they realized that there were so many different ways in which different societies practiced love that were considered approved, that were considered normal, that there isn't just one way, you know. And they go away saying, okay, so now I have all these different models, you know, and I can interpret love the way that it resonates with me and develop my own talent to love. And that way I can optimize the resources of love that we have in society, because we don't tell anyone, your way of loving is bad.
Well, and you've talked about the fear of love.
Yes.
Where do you think that originates from? You said you think it's because people conceptualize it as an instinct, and therefore it's out of control. But still, in the culture, it's very interesting how even just recently, Justice Scalia of the Supreme Court was quoted as saying, if we ever do censor video games, it'll be the ones that have sex in them, not the violent ones.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that we're on a planet right now that is not really that afraid of one of our instincts that's out of control, which is violence. Doesn't seem to be very many taboos around that. And yet there's this fear, almost obsessive fear about anything sexual. And I'm just wondering if you have any theories on how that those two got differentiated. And
right. Well, precisely this is, first of all, love got differentiated from sex, right? So people believe that in order to have sex, one has to have romance and exclusivity, right? If there is romance and there is exclusivity, then sex is permitted, and people are told that it's okay to have sex when mm-hmm. the combination of these three comes together, okay? In any other case, sex is considered divorced from love. And that's the first mistake that we have made, is to really divide sex from love. In classical societies, this is just to give a very small example. In classical societies, the nuptial bed, the bed where the bride and the groom consumed their love, where they had sex, was the altar of the sacrament of marriage. In Christian societies, we first go to church. We consecrate the couple, and then they can consume their marriage. You see what I mean? So
yeah.
we have segregated love from sex, right?
Yeah.
So, but that is also, it is a cultural construct. If you go to pre-Christian societies, and I'm talking about the Western tradition, I'm not going to India now, but in the very tradition that is mainstream, in pre-Christian societies, there wasn't that divorce. The wedding was a sacrament consumed on the wedding bed. You see? And the whole group of people in the household prepared that bed. It was considered an altar. You see? With that separation, then we end up criminalizing forms of sex that are not associated with exclusivity and are not associated with romance. But if we turn that around, we can see that maybe some forms of sexual expression are actually some talents of love that don't fall exactly in that paradigm. And I don't know, there was another question that you asked that was quite interesting, and I'm not sure I remember exactly what it was.
Well, one of the things that I wondered is that, you know, with the fear of sex and of love, and also it seems like you're using those terms interchangeably to some extent.
Yeah.
And perhaps I'm mistaken about that, and if so, then please, you know, elaborate on that. But if you are conflating the terms love and sex, then maybe you could explain why you are, and I think what I heard you say basically is that they should not have been separated and you're kind of rejoining them. But could you talk about that a little bit more?
I am rejoining them. When I'm speaking of the arts of loving, I'm speaking of what a lot of people know as sexuality or sexual expression. Okay? Mm-hmm. And again, I'm going back to a pre-Christian tradition that also was considered in the, continued in the modern era. I mean, quite recent book about the arts of loving is Eric Fromm's title by, a book by that title, The Arts of Loving, Eric Fromm from the Frankfurt School. But there are many previous books from the classical age. Ovid wrote a book called The Arts of Loving. So there were many, many times, many cultures where love was considered an art. Lovemaking was considered an art. And almost anything that we know about as sexual expression can be considered as an art, you know, as part, one example of the arts of loving. But what's important in the concept of the arts of loving is that sex is this instinct, this desire, but it can be trained, you see. It can be developed as a talent. Whereas if we consider, if we stay with within the realm of sexuality, sexuality is a modern concept that was invented to legitimize sexual activity, to free it from the stigma of sin, you see, and considered like a scientific necessity. But when we speak of sexuality, we still are in the realm of need. In other words, when sexologists invented the concept of sexuality, they said, okay, sex is not a sin, it's a need. Okay?
Exactly.
But we stay within the realm of need. When we go to the arts of loving, we go one step further. We say, sure, sex is a need. Nobody is denying that sex is a need. But what if we also interpret it as an art? Okay, then we interpret these talents as talents in the arts of loving, these sexual desires, we interpret them as talents in the arts of loving that can be developed, that can be trained, so that those who have these talents can become resources of love. I don't know if that helps.
Well, I think it's becoming clearer. So basically, and I have been cognizant of that that overlay, which is, you know, very strong in sexological circles, health circles. I mean, sex is put into this idea as a necessary evil by some religious institutions, but even in, you know, the medical profession, I think sex then just becomes kind of like going to the bathroom. Something the human body has to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And it's not that I'm saying that it isn't, but it's a lot more. It's what we were saying before about orgasm. Is orgasm only the time when the man ejaculates and the sperm leaves the penis and falls in whatever containment it's supposed to fall? Or is orgasm really a way of life? You see.
Say more about orgasm as a way of life. What would that look like?
Well, you know, some tantric teachers claim that they live lives that are orgasmic. I mean, they're always on that plateau of ecstasy. Mm. You see? And that's something that I think when we expand the range of sensations and expand the range of emotions and accept that the inclusiveness, you know, become more inclusive in our amorous practice and more fluid in our sexual practice, then we can come closer to living life in this tantric way and really experiencing constantly this ecstasy. And often, you know, we think of, even without going very far, contemplation, you know, contemplation of the beauty of nature, sometimes it can give you this ecstasy. In other words, you can consider contemplation of the beauty of the stars and an orgasmic experience. In this way, I think we also assuage a bit this fear of sex, because if we consider sex or orgasm only that restrictive genital activity and its climax, then, you know, then it becomes fearful, because just that one thing that maybe somebody, some people don't want that form. But if we expand it, then we can see that almost any experience that has some mystical aspect to it can be considered an erotic experience.
Well,
I talk about erotophilia in a society that loves love. A society that loves love is a society that can also produce it.
And do you think a society that loves love might be more peaceful?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, and less violent. See, when we unlearn to love love, when we become afraid of love, we lose the ability to produce it because we are taught that we shouldn't love love, we should fear it. Right? But when we turn that around and we turn that fear into love, then we start loving love and then we become more peaceful. And that happens for individuals and for society.
Well, it sounds like a beautiful world. I hope it arrives soon.
Right.
Serena,
we're
hopeful. About out of time here, so we're going to have to wrap this up. But if you could just tell the listeners about your upcoming conference at the Temple of Arts in Canada.
Yes, my next appearance will be at the ISTA, ISTA Conference, International School of Temple Arts in Toronto. It's October 13 to 15, I believe, and it's a conference organized by ISTA, but perhaps the theme will be ecosexuality, but I'm not absolutely sure, and I will be speaking on that topic, ecosexual love, why we need more schools of love, why we need to cultivate these talents more.
Beautiful, beautiful. And if our listeners want to contact you, would it be best for them to go to your blog?
Yes, I absolutely invite everyone to visit my blog. It's Polyplanet Gaia. It's polyplanet.blogspot.com, and everyone can sign up as a follower. I really appreciate that. Publishers also appreciate that, and I plan to write a book soon on what is love. And also, I can be there is a fan page for my latest book, Gaia and the New Politics of Love, on Facebook, and also I have a profile there. And I have a YouTube channel in my name also, Serena Anderlini. So
fabulous.
I hope that people can reach me easily that way, leave messages, ask for friendship on Facebook, become fans of Gaia and the New Politics of Love, or leave a comment on YouTube.
Okay. Well, really love the stuff that you're putting out into the world, and I hope I get to come to one of your presentations. The next time you're in San Francisco, please make sure I get the date so I can come out.
Thank you, Veronica. It was wonderful to do this podcast with you.
Thank you, Serena. I know it kept you up past midnight, so I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
All right. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak menutup kabar berita?